Happy to hear argument in our third case, 14-1227, Certain Underwriters v. Max Cohen.
May it please the court, Eric Fry on behalf of the defendant appellants Harry Max Cohen, M.D. and Harry Max Cohen, M.D. Chartered. I'd like to give a little bit of a factual background so we can understand how these policies came to be written, and I won't spend very much time, but my client was solicited. He was solicited specifically by people who held themselves out as being specialists in underwriting high-end disability policies for surgeons in particular who had difficulty getting other types of insurance.
That is actually interesting, but is that in the record somewhere?
That is in the record, actually. It's in Dr. Cohen's affidavit starting on page 339.
Okay.
Dr. Cohen is solicited, and Dr. Cohen is referred to Peterson. Peterson. So that everybody is clear, Peterson is what we call a cover holder for the underwriters. The underwriters are actually in London, and they are a group of people who signed off on what's called a facility. We have heard nothing at all from these underwriters about their standards or their guidelines to underwrite any policy that was issued here. We don't even have correspondence between any of the any Peterson and the underwriters. All we have is correspondence between Peterson and Ticers. Ticers is what we call the London broker. The London broker is the only person to whom Peterson has contact. And this is really important when it gets to the issue of materiality, because it's their job to prove that the underwriters would not have written this policy if they had known certain facts. Well, the underwriters have never spoken here. We have Peterson, who's literally three or four links up the chain, because there are the underwriters in London at Lloyd's. There is the lead underwriter at Lloyd's, that's ARC 420. We then have Ticers, who is the London broker. Then we get to Peterson, then we get to Marler, then we get to the doctor. Now, this is critical because it's their obligation to prove that this policy would not have been written. And the only thing they have in this case is evidence from Peterson that saying he wouldn't have tried to get the underwriters to write the policy. Well, that's sort of really self-serving, and there's no real evidence that he would have done that. And he's not qualified as an expert in Lloyd's custom and practice by the court below, so how does he even know what they would or wouldn't have
said? Are you foregoing the argument that about the whether or not these were lies?
Oh, not at all, Your Honor.
Okay.
I have five.
Materiality only comes in if you have a misrepresentation,
I'm only talking about materiality at this particular moment because there's absolutely nothing from the underwriters. My client told the truth through the entire process here, at least the truth from his perspective, based on his understanding of what the application was, based upon what the application was asking him. That is, in fact, what Maryland law says. Maryland law says, under the Pfeiffer case, Continental versus Pfeiffer case, and the Hendricks case, and the Collier case, that a person given the application reasonably interprets the questions. And if that interpretation from their perspective is reasonable, then they have not misrepresented. And in this case, clearly Dr. Cohen did not misrepresent anything. But this is, going back to the start of this, he fills out the application first on April 1st, 2011. It asks some general questions about his occupation. He's a surgeon, been a surgeon for 40 years. He's been on the cutting edge for 40 years. In terms of cancer research and cancer surgery, Dr. Cohen gets this application, and he fills it out and he answers the questions correctly. These are specialists in underwriting high-end disability policies for surgeons, and what don't they ask? They don't ask anything about his license. They don't ask anything about whether he's got board action against him. Dr. Cohen has two licenses at all points in this case, as a matter of fact. He has one in Maryland, one in D.C. His office is within walking distance of the District of Columbia. He has privileges in both Maryland and D.C., or has had privileges at both Maryland and D.C. throughout the course of his practice. Dr. Cohen is not asked, although for 40 years he's been answering insurance applications, especially for malpractice, questions about his licensure. There was no question ever directed to him from the underwriters who are holding themselves out, or their agent, their cover holder, Peterson's holding themselves out as a specialist in underwriting doctors. This makes no sense, and it doesn't elicit any prompt to him to actually answer this question. Answer the question of, oh, yes, by the way, I have a small suspension. I have a 90-day suspension in Maryland, which, as I'm sure your honors are aware, we do not believe is admissible under any circumstance, and I'll get to that as well. Dr. Cohen then fills out the application on April 1st. For the next 4 months, Peterson's kicking the tires, going back and forth with Tyser, coming back to him asking for more financial data, coming back to him asking for more medical data. They never ask a single question about any of the questions on the front page of the four-page application, despite the fact that he had written on top of one of the questions, the one about financial stability and occupation, that he was opening a D.C. office. It didn't prompt a single question. Now, Dr. Cohen's finalized his application on August 8th, 2011. At that point, the coverage is put into place in effect. All of the coverage in these policies has at least a 90-day elimination clause. During the 90 days, immediately after the beginning of the policy, he cannot collect any benefits. What he can collect, he can suffer the injury, and that's what this policy insures against, is the injury that would prevent you from performing the act of surgery. But you can't collect benefits until you've been disabled for at least 90 days. He is suspended in Maryland, as the court is aware, on or about August 5th of 2011. He's automatically reinstated on November 5th of 2011. During this time, he has a license, still valid license in the District of Columbia, and still can do the other aspects of his practice as a surgeon, as a doctor. And he is in the office, and he goes to the office, and he's doing paperwork. He's planning the move to D.C. He's finishing up his research, which just happens to be what got him in trouble with the board in the first place, the research which I understand is actually now standard of care. But he is then coming out of his office on September 8th, 2011, trips and falls and suffers an injury that we've all agreed disables him and qualifies him for coverage under the policy.
He's not practicing medicine anymore?
He is disabled from this injury.
I understand that, but is it a disabling?
Yeah, it's permanent. It's permanent. Dr. Cohen was 70 years old when he filled out the initial application. He's now, I think, 74. He broke his hand, and he can't
manipulate. You're not suggesting 74 is over the hill, are you?
I am not at all,
Your
Honor.
I play approaching.
Just let the record reflect. I play basketball every Sunday with a guy who's 78.
Well, you're not 74.
Oh, I'm nowhere near 74. But, Your Honor, What happens here is the underwriters have disclaimed coverage because of an order issued by the board. Orders by the board are absolutely not admissible in Maryland. The statute 14410, Health Occupations 14410, is crystal clear on this issue. Unless there is an express stipulation and consent between the parties.
Have you found a Maryland Attorney General's opinion or any Maryland case law on this, or any case law on a similar statute in another state?
Your Honor, what there is has been cited.
I guess the answer is no.
Well, there are two cases in Maryland which address the issue: the COCO versus Medical Board, and the unnamed physician versus Medical Board, which talk about the precursor statute, which say, we cannot conceive of any way that this can be used in any civil action except when the physician themselves is suing the board.
So, you see, we have the confluence in this statute that the order is public.
Right.
But it can't be used in any litigation. It seems weird. They go two ways.
Is it, though, if you read the statute together and you recognize that all the orders of the board are public, that's 14.411, but there are many documents that are public that are not admissible.
Mm-hmm. 14.410. But it just seems, there's I haven't found that in another state statute either, that confluence of admissibility but public.
Maryland has a unique legislature at times, but it's.
But often when they institute legislation, they look at some uniform, mind of man only has a certain amount of imagination, and we're always copying off of each other.
I understand that. I won't pretend to understand what the legislature meant to do, except that they did change and tighten up the wording in 2013. So clearly, the wording that goes back to 79 in the precursor statute, the wording that was in place at the time of this event, and the wording that comes into play in 2013 are absolutely clear, not admissible, and this should not be admitted. And the judge erred when she allowed it to be used, and that is the gravamen of their
and I'm correct that it was attached to the complaint, because we don't have copy of the complaint in the JA. We have the amended complaint.
Well, the amended
but the first document we have is your motion not to admit it.
Right.
But it was, as I understand it, we went and looked at Pacer, and it is in the original complaint too.
The amended complaint simply removed the underwriter's contention that he was not disabled, and they agreed that he was disabled.
Okay, but so the answer to my question is yes.
Yes.
And then the explanation is the only change is the one you just talked about.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
With regard to the questions, from my client's perspective, he answered them truthfully. The questions were designed by.
Can I ask you just one more thing about this order? It seems to me, though, that your client has admitted in pleadings all the facts that are contained, all the bad facts, if you will, that are contained in the order.
Well,
so is it if it's error, is that error harmless?
Not at all, Your Honor.
Okay.
We, as a matter of fact, when we answered the complaint,
because there's a finding here as a matter of law. This isn't like this was influenced some fact finder.
Right.
Right.
We. Objected from the very beginning in our answer to citing 14.410, saying that this order was not admissible, and we had a continuing objection up until the point, obviously, where the judge denied our motion in limine, in which case, we believe that was error, and the statute, the order should never be admitted into evidence.
I understand that's your position. I'm asking you whether that any error was harmless. And I guess what you're saying is that your client's affidavit only followed, or maybe you can tell me, did it only follow the magistrate judge's determination that she was going to allow this?
It came in response to the motion for summary judgment.
Yeah, so it was later.
So it was much later. Yes. Thank you, Your Honor. Is there any other questions before I sit down?
Thank you.
May it please the court and counsel, I'm Neil Novak, and I represent the appellees in this matter. I will start first with the question of the statute that we were just discussing, and with respect to the district court's ruling granting the motion or denying the motion to eliminate, I'm going to stand on what I submitted in the brief for the purposes of explaining the district court's ruling. What I do want to discuss, though, I think is the last point that was just raised by Judge Motz and the question of the other evidence in the record. And we submit that other evidence establishes both the fact of Dr. Cohen's suspension and the terms of the probation. And that's all we really cared about. That was the use of the consent order that we wanted to put it to for purposes of the representation.
Well, have you found any authority that supports your view of what Maryland law is with respect to this order?
With respect to the statute?
Indeed.
I agree with Mr. Fry. I think all the cases and everything have been cited.
Well, how do you get around then the ban on admissibility?
A couple of things. the district court judge and I read the statute a little bit differently, where it says if there is
each other or
no together differently from Mr. Fry.
That
if there's consent of the parties to a proceeding before the board, which was the board and Dr. Cohn, then in a civil case you can use proceedings from the board, you can use an order of the board.
But then it would say that every, because there's always, I don't.
Well, no. This is my second point on the question of Your Honor's comment about other evidence in the record. There is other evidence in the record attached to Dr. Cohen's affidavit, which was.
But the affidavit wasn't purported until after there'd been the ruling with respect to the Maryland statute, correct?
That's correct. But he attaches to his affidavit as Exhibit A, pages 346, 7, and 8, another order of the board. He didn't consent to this order, but it was the order that was suspending.
But he only put it in after he lost the point.
No. He says he's preserving his objection throughout the whole thing.
It doesn't make any difference if you make it once and it's rejected. You know, you're a trial lawyer. You go right along. I mean, the district court may be wrong, but that's the law of the case. It stands right there, and you go up on appeal. And you offer all the evidence and all the arguments you do with the record as it is in front of you now. You don't say, well, I'm just going to withhold my evidence and I'm going to withhold my arguments because I think your initial ruling was wrong.
Well, if he'd used the same order, it was a different order that was not consented to by Dr. Cohen, number one. Number two, it had the same information in it that was in the consent order. And beyond that, too, we still have the request.
It wasn't offered before the magistrate judge had made her ruling, correct?
That's correct.
Okay.
That's correct. And then in addition to that, we have the request for admissions where Dr. Cohn did also admit that he did not advise Peterson International.
And was that done before she made her ruling?
I can't recall the exact time on that, Your Honor. Those requests for admissions are in the record attached to our opposition to the motion to certify, but I can't recall the precise date on when we submitted those.
Okay.
Those were the two.
It would not be the date. Wouldn't be when you submitted them. The date would be when they responded.
That's what I meant to say. That when they were executed. So I think that beyond the question of the strict reading of the statute, I think the district court's rationale and plus the fact of the other evidence in the record supports the conclusion that simply the fact of the suspension and the probation, which was significant as well, have already been established in multiple ways. So we would urge the court to say you could affirm the district court on this. You could find that the issue is moot because of the existence of other record of other evidence. You could find Dr. Cohn waived it because of the use of the other evidence in the record. Or you could find that if you do think that there was an abuse of discretion, which is the standard that applies here, that it was simply harmless error because of the other evidence in the record. But all of those points bring us to the same result, and that is that the Petersons were unaware of the material facts when they were analyzing and underwriting these policies. And Mr. Peterson, Thomas Peterson, did testify at his deposition that the Petersons did perform the physical underwriting of these particular policies. So I'll talk more about Mr. Peterson in a minute. But moving on to the summary judgment, I think there's a fundamental question that needs to be asked about why we're here to begin with. And that starts with the question of what was Dr. Cohn purchasing? And the easy answer is disability insurance. But the second question and the important question is, what protection does disability insurance provide? And the answer to that is it provides protection from the interruption of one's earned income stream. And that's key to understanding the materiality and the misrepresentation piece of it.
Well, although nobody seems to want to talk about the policy, I would have thought the policy language would be pretty important in this case.
Well, we're going
you're
to
getting there.
Okay. Well, I'm not going to talk about the policy language because it's a rescission. It's a rescission argument. So we're going to be talking about the misrepresentations.
So you have to talk about the misrepresentations to questions made in the policy whether they're material or there is no case here, right?
I think we're confusing application and policy. And the application was, in fact, attached to the policy. So, yes, Your Honor, I'm going to get to that. So the district court, we submit, correctly determined that the only type of insurable income is earned income, and that was the Schreiber case. We also presented a treatise, Charles Soleil, on the nature of the insurable interests in disability cases.
And so once we establish that disability insurance covers the fortuity against interruption from earned income, you can then move on to the question of the misrepresentations, and you can see why they're material. So turning to the misrepresentations, there are two of them that we point to in the record. The first one is question number one, are you actively at work? Dr. Cohen answered yes to that question. And the second question was, are you aware of any fact that could change your occupation or financial stability? And he answered no to that question. So Dr. Cohen justified the response to being at work by saying that during the terms of his suspension, he was often home after midnight. And we would submit that there's a difference between being at work and being at the office. So one of the things you look at is, well, if he's at work, what's he doing? What we know is what he told us on the application, and I'm going to come back to that in a second. The second question about the financial stability, he justified that by saying he had a good net worth, which is irrelevant also in our view on the point.
Well, it may be irrelevant, but if these questions are ambiguous, you lose, right?
If they're ambiguous?
Indeed. No?
I don't think so, Your Honor.
Not on summary judgment?
I think the question of the ambiguity.
You can ask ambiguous questions, and you still are entitled to summary judgment here?
Your Honor, you have to take the whole context here. If they were truly ambiguous, I understand what you're saying on that.
They are ambiguous.
So ambiguous.
Well, let me move to the application itself. The application has three parts to it. It has personal information, it has financial information, it has medical information. If you look at the first part of the application for the personal information, they're blanks. So the applicant has the opportunity to describe certain things. What's your occupation?
You are stating the two things were lies. And, you know, let's talk about those two things.
Well, I don't have to say he lied, Your Honor. I just have to say there were misrepresentations.
Okay, he misrepresented. Let's talk about those two misrepresentations.
I'm trying to do that if I can.
Stay at work. You're right there. Stay, go back
right,
to work.
Right.
That's not ambiguous.
There are three questions. There are three questions that we're looking at on the top of the application. Your occupation, your daily duties, and your specialty. He said surgeon, surgery, surgery. It is in the context of what's provided up top that where there's the misrepresentation.
Right, he's a surgeon. That's undisputed. Now, let's go back to the question. Are you at work? That was
right.
The question, right?
That's right.
He said yes.
That's right.
Let me ask you a question. You're a surgeon. Suppose he's there, and for 1 month, no one comes in for surgery. Is he still at work as a surgeon?
Yes, he is.
Okay, then. So it has nothing to do with whether or not you're actually doing surgeries. Correct? You can still be at work. You agree with that?
Your Honor, I agree. Yes, I agree. Right. I agree. But the difference is because his license was suspended, he could not have performed a surgery during the period of the suspension.
Well, was he licensed in the District of Columbia at the same time?
He was, but his license was that there was also
I
probation.
I understand that, but at that exact moment when he signs this, is he licensed in the District of Columbia?
I understand he was, but I don't understand he had an office there.
If I remember what he says in his deposition is that he was doing billing, that he was doing – those are all kinds of, you know, if you're in private practice, that we would certainly count billing as work, right?
Important aspect of work.
Your Honor, we have to come back to the question of earned income. And his earned income stream was interrupted when he was suspended. And that's what you look at for setting what the value is for the premium benefits. So if you have a different cause or a different reason that interrupts why you can't make money, as it turns out, Dr. Cohen had his accident three weeks after he was suspended. He wasn't earning income at the time. He says he was depositing checks, and he was doing
things. I'm sorry, which of these two misrepresentations are you talking about now?
I'm talking about at work.
Okay.
I haven't gotten
to it. It sounded like you were getting into it.
The financial stability, and the same thing. I mean, if your earned income stream is disrupted because it's suspended, then your financial stability in the context of what can be insurable in a disability policy has been disrupted.
If someone asked me about my financial stability, let's leave aside the at work for a moment, but it seems to me that financial stability is you're looking at are you financially stable? I'm as simple-minded as I am. It doesn't necessarily mean that it's earned income. It can be unearned income.
Unearned income is not insurable, so we don't look at that.
Does the policy say no unearned income counts, no It doesn't say that. Now, maybe you can get an expert to testify that everybody in the world knows that. But that's not what the question is.
No, the question has to do with what his income was. He submitted his tax returns. His tax returns show earned and unearned. But the opportunity to look at what is actually earned income is what the underwriters look at.
And they say, are you financially stable? They don't say, what is your earned income? Or will your earned income continue?
No, but it's what they look at, because that's what they're insuring.
What they look at and what they ask are different matters.
Right. He's not supposed to read their minds.
And that brings to the duty to investigate, I suppose, is one of the questions that we have here. If we were supposed to ask further questions about Dr. Cohn's situation, is that what Your Honor is getting at here?
I'm just getting at whether or not these questions are ambiguous. It seems to me if they're ambiguous, you'd lose. And so I'm trying to get you to tease out to me how they're not ambiguous. And you say, well, all we're concerned about is earned income. But it doesn't say that on the form.
Your Honor, he is the architect of that application. So he can put anything he wants in that. He could have said, I'm a surgeon, I teach, I lecture, I'm an author. He could have done all that.
He wasn't asked that.
He was asked what his occupation was in the first part.
Right.
So he only said surgery. That's all we knew. So we said, okay, surgery. His license to perform surgeries is suspended. He is not at work performing surgeries. The only conclusion you can draw, reasonable conclusion, from the application is he was not actively at work performing surgeries when, in fact, he knew on the date that he submitted the application that he was going to be suspended. And, in fact, on the date that he signed the final application, August 8, 2011, he was suspended, and that was the date that the policy was issued. So when the policy was issued, he was suspended. He did not have any earned income. And that's the point of what the disability policy is supposed to cover. So that's where the moral hazard issue comes into the question, and why there was a misrepresentation that was material. The district court concluded that the answers were patently false. And in light of the totality of the circumstances as to what this type of insurance provides, they were incorrect or false or misleading or misrepresentations, whatever.
Can I ask you a question?
Yes.
Surgeons perform surgery, but they also do surgery consults. Can they not earn income from that? I mean, that's, if he said, I'm at work, I'm still consulting, he's going to get paid for it. That's going to be earned income.
That's not in the record, Your Honor, and I don't know if I can answer that, based on what we know. So we don't have that. So I think the...
When you say earned income, are you talking from an IRS standpoint? What the definition of earned income is?
I'm talking about what he...
Because if a surgeon performs three surgeries and has not been paid, he has no earned income.
No,
you don't pay taxes on receivables.
I understand.
Well, what are you talking? You said earned income. You said it's not ambiguous. Is it a legal term under the IRS code?
Your Honor, on a tax return, they always look at the tax returns. If he reports zero income...
Don't get away from me. Earned income is a definition under the code. I used to be a tax lawyer.
Yeah.
I'm asking you whether or not that is it an earned income definition under the code, because you don't pay taxes on receivables.
I understand that, Your Honor. You're correct.
Okay.
But again, we're...
So in other words, when he billed for it, it was earned then. So it was earned income.
I don't know if he was an accrual basis taxpayer or a taxpayer.
No. And these questions certainly don't go into that.
No, they don't. They don't at all. But the question is if he doesn't get paid for doing work and he submits a tax return that shows he made $100 in 1 year, he's not going to qualify for disability insurance at the level he's asking for.
Go back to what we are said are the facts here. It says, are you financially stable, or what to financial stability? And he says, yes. And he says that I'm billing for things, and when I bill them, somebody pays, they're earned then.
So your
distinction between earned income and unearned income really doesn't work.
I think the record does not reflect that, Your Honor. I think the record was that he was...
Well, it may not, but we're here on summary judgment.
Maybe
you're going to win if this goes to trial.
I understand, Your Honor. What the district court looked at and what we were talking about was simply... basic notion of what a disability policy covers, and he provided information that satisfied underwriters for purposes of issuing the policies. They subsequently learned that he was suspended, and that goes to the core of what the disability policies were intended to be covering. And that's why they said that was a misrepresentation. You weren't actively at work performing surgeries. That's what you told us you were doing. I get Your Honor's question that you certainly aren't every single minute of the day in an operating room performing surgeries or in a clinical setting performing excisional biopsies or whatever Dr. Cohen was doing. I understand that. The question was, he could have been, unless his license was suspended. And it's that artificial interruption of the earned income stream that's at the core of the problem with whether there was a truthful, accurate statement about are you actively at work, when what he said was, my work is performing surgeries. That's what he told us.
I think you make a good argument, but I think a jury could perhaps disagree.
We are here on summary judgment, and the district court, I think, had the correct authority in the cases that were cited with Essex and Fitzgerald.
Summary judgment, the hearing is over the phone. Does she make a determination over the phone?
No, there was no argument. The oral argument was on the motion in limine that was telephonic.
So never an argument?
Not
on the phone or otherwise?
For the summary judgment, there was not. It was just on the briefs. And on the question of materiality, the court also noted that it can be determined as a matter of law, and in the district court's opinion,
but not usually is.
If the evidence is clear, unconvincing, and uncontradictory,
right?
Right.
I don't know if there are other. I think I do want to comment just briefly on Thomas Peterson. Mr. Fry made some comments about Thomas Peterson. He was not an insignificant player in the role here, and Peterson International was not an insignificant entity here. Mr. Peterson testified that he and the PIU team, Peterson International Underwriting Team, bound these policies, did the physical underwriting. There were transmissions to London back and forth. The lead underwriter did see the materials. Those are in the record, too. You'll see some, what they call scratch on some emails. There were questions that were raised. There were negotiations on the question of the D.C. office. Mr. Fry says there were no questions at all. There were questions. 588 to 592 of the record show an exchange of emails between Mr. Marler, who was Dr. Cohen's agent, and Peterson's, trying to get his high-limit disability income level up from $7,900, which is what he qualified for under his tax returns, to he wanted $15,000. They went to 10. They went to $10,000 because of this thing about the D.C. office, and that's in the record. So there were negotiations, and there were exchanges, and there was underwriting that was done in this case. And it wasn't as if people just looked at an application, said, oh, okay, fine, rubber stamp here, let's go issue a policy. There were significant exchanges, and it was underwritten in the normal course of the way these matters happen. But Peterson's has a 30-year experience with London. In fact, Mr. Peterson's father was the original drafter of the policy that's evolved over the years. Underwriters respect them, look to them for guidance, and rely on them. So they had a significant role in this. It isn't as if there was no communication or contact with underwriters. It was significant.
Is this Peterson, Howell, and Heather? Is it the same Peterson?
No, it's Peterson International Underwriting.
But in the olden days, there was Peterson, Howell, and Heather.
It's always
I thought maybe that was the father.
Yeah, in California, Harold Peterson. So the point is the point is that Mr. Peterson had significant involvement in this, and said that this never would have gotten to the lead underwriter had he known about the suspension and had he known about the probation. And so when they say no evidence that the insurers would not have issued policy, there was. It never would have gotten to the insurers to begin with to issue the policy. I see my light is on. If there are no further questions.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Your Honors, what Mr. Peterson might or might not have done had he known and asked questions that he should have asked is immaterial. The question is, what would have the underwriters done on the issue of materiality? And there's no evidence of that. This got through Peterson. It got to the underwriters, as the Hendricks case tells us and the Collier case tells us. The requirement then is for them to prove that ARC 420 and all of the 17 other underwriters that are involved here had a guideline of some sort that said, we don't issue policies to people who have a temporary suspension on one of their two surgeon's licenses.
They didn't do that, and without that, summary judgment should have actually been granted for the defendants in this case. With regard to nearly every aspect that Mr. Peterson raised, Mr. Page, who is a qualified expert in the standards and practice of Lloyd's, disputes that, and certainly at least a jury question is involved.
Well, let me ask you about a jury question. Did you ask for a jury trial?
We did not.
They haven't asked for a jury trial.
Right. But a finder of fact, a trial, Your Honor.
Okay. I thought you said a jury just now.
Well, I did say jury question because I referred to them as jury questions.
Okay.
The other thing is the statute, the standard is de novo review. That's the Clark versus Absolute case that you all just ruled on about a year ago. If there's no other questions, then I'll sit down.
Thank you very much. We will ask our clerk to adjourn court, and then we'll come down and greet the lawyers.